Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Hello everybody and a very warm welcome to this latest Motorsport Magazine podcast. And believe it or not, we are coming to you from the Goodwood Revival. We are in the Rolex Drivers' Mess, where you'll find more racing drivers at one time than in any other place in the world. And we have with us, to start our podcast today, Sir Stirling Moss. And we'll be talking later on to many of the other drivers who are here for this incredible Goodwood Revival. Stirling, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back and on a lovely sunny day.
Now, you're a man who knows just a bit about racing at Goodwood. So tell us, first of all, a little bit about the circuit where we are today.
Well, the circuit is much more difficult than you think. I mean, it's 2.3 miles, I think. And the chicane looks a big deal, it isn't. I mean, the chicane really, it's quite easy to hit it, but I mean, it's not a serious corner. But then when you get past there and go up into the first corner, that's quite difficult because it's a double. And if you get it right, you can get through there really very fast. And that, of course, affects your speed on the fast bit of the circuit over by Fordwater and so on. So that's important. Then you come through Fordwater, which is a very difficult corner. Then you've got a left-hander, which is not difficult, but you can make up a bit of time on braking some way. Then you come around and then you get into the straight, and the straight, you've got to remember here, is actually about 200 yards longer or 300 yards longer than it looks, because you've got your flat out in third, or depending obviously on the car, the gears you've got, but in my case a third gear, and so you've got quite a long run in, a flat out run into the straight. The straight is not straight, it's got kinks on it. The problem with that is that if the driver isn't looking in his mirror and assisting the one overtaking him, that can be very dangerous. I mean, and I just hope that people will look in the mirror and see if there's a guy coming and then tell him which side to go. And so you go down there, and then of course you've got some hard braking, and then you've got quite an interesting with the grandstands on the left, when you don't want to make a mess of it because too many people see what you've done. Then you're through that polystyrene chicane, which to me is an absolute pain in the neck, but there you are, that's what chicanes are.
Well, I should have mentioned at the beginning of our podcast today that we also have with us our editor-in-chief, Nigel Roebuck, and our editor, Damien Smith, so we'll all be joining in. Nigel, in the old days, of course, the chicane was made of bricks.
It was indeed, and in fact, I wasn't actually here. I came to Goodwood first, I think, in 1955. I was brought here, my parents. But in 58, the Glover Trophy, my great hero, my childhood hero, Jean Behra, lost the brakes of the BRM coming into the chicane. It was a big accident. And in fact, he almost came out of the car, because there were no belts in those days.
Yeah, no, he was half out of the car.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So, no, it was quite solid back then. Yeah.
The thing is, Stirling, that, you know, as we've often talked about, it was highly, highly dangerous in those days. And here we are with almost the same cars. All right, they're prepared differently, shall we say. But, you know, Goodwood is potentially, you know, it's quick, isn't it?
Yeah, but one of the reasons one races is because one wants to frighten oneself. I mean, you know, people talk about all this stupid safety stuff. I mean, if you go around and you feel fully safe, then what exhilaration are you getting? I mean, it's a loaded modern bull. I mean, it's really for Formula One with all the spin-off area. And I must say, I think driving around here is very, very rewarding if you can get it right. If you don't, then it can be very expensive. There's no doubt about it. But if you go around the back, for instance, you get all that done tidily, you feel, my God, well, I really have done a good job there. Unfortunately, when you get to 81, as I am now, I'm not as fast as I was. And so my problem is, of course, I look in the mirror as much as I do the ruddy road, and thank God I know where the road goes.
I mean, you had, as everyone knows, some truly magnificent races here. And if I could just pick one out of the hat, the Tourist Trophy in Rob Walker's Ferrari.
Yeah.
Now, it's always been said that you were so far in the lead, you were listening to the wireless in the car.
Well, that wasn't because I was lost in the lead. I mean, the reason I was happened to be in the lead, that's true. But the reason was I wanted to know what went on with the whole race. So I had my own pit signals, of course, given by my pit, saying you are first, second, or whatever it is, and you're minus this. Whereas if you got onto the radio, you heard Raymond Baxter saying, look, this guy's leading that class, and that was quite interesting. And of course, in the Ferrari, and with the helmet I wore then, of course, which I wear today, I could still hear. And, you know, it's not a noisy car. I mean, it's a very quiet car relative to racing cars. So I could keep up with what's going on right through the whole race. It was very good.
Well, I hope you listening to us can hear what we're saying, because we're right next to the driver's mess here is right next to the airfield, and there's a Spitfire warming up outside right now. So we just hope you can hear us.
Actually, if I may interrupt you, I think you'll find there's a hurricane, isn't it? I'm not too sure. You know, I mean... To me, a Spitfire is a nervous hurricane. You know, I mean, a Spitfire. I think a Spitfire must have handled like a good Lotus. A bit dodgy, you know.
One of the joys of having you is your constant attention to detail.
Thank you.
Okay, and joining us now, this program's going to be a little bit sort of, you know, let's see what happens next. But anyway, what has happened next? Is that Bobby Rahal has sat down on one of our lovely wicker sofas here. Bobby, thanks very much, and welcome to our podcast.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's good seeing you. We talk to each other over the phone all the time, and of course, always Nigel. It's always good to see him, and the ace here. I don't know why.
I like your hair style.
I know. It's, you know, high speed. It's built for high speed circuits. But
perhaps we should just explain that neither Bobby nor Sir Sterling have lots of hair on top of their head.
Look at the three of them. I think there's something there.
I think you can, yeah.
The same
you can,
goes
you
for
can include me in that, Robert.
All I know is it takes me about 5 minutes to get ready for dinner.
Well, I'll tell you, the trouble with having too much hair, all the time you waste with the damn stuff.
That's right.
I mean, as
right.
it is now, I mean, a quick polish
and
you're
out.
You
always have to worry about how you look. You know, exactly. Does my hair look okay? Heck with it.
Hey, Bobby, I think you better tell us what you're racing this weekend.
I was racing three cars. I think one of those is going to probably be retired here before too much damage is done. But I'm racing with Adrian Newey again in his lightweight E-Type. And, of course, we won the TT last year. And so now the pressure's really on. You know, it's a fabulous car. And last year was a thrill. That's a tough race to win anyway. I don't care, you know, what you've done in the past, because everybody wants to win it, and everybody's trying hard, and so it's a great car, a fabulous car to drive, and Adrian's a pretty good driver in his own right, so it's, you know, that's always a good time. And then I'm really thrilled. I'm going to drive a D-Type this year, Nigel Webb's D-Type, and which is I've driven a D-Type once before, and I found it to be such a great car to drive, so I'm really excited about that.
Bobby, has he given you the legal one?
Oh, I don't know. I hope not. I hope it's not the legal one.
I hope you've got one of the 3.8 engines.
I need as much help as I can get. So I hope it's I hope it's a 4.2. You know.
The D type, of course, didn't run with anything bigger than 3.4, did it, in its era?
3.8. Yeah.
Sorry. You may have a legal one.
Well, we never know. All I know is it's here. So. And then I have I own a Brabham BT8 BRM, a little 2-liter BRM engine, and unfortunately it makes a lot of noise, but it's not going very fast. So I think there's something wrong with it. So rather than scatter its remains across the the countryside, I think we'll probably park that one. But it's still fun to come here, and even if you only drive one car, it's still a great thrill.
So sometimes people ask you guys, you know, you've done it all, you've been there, you've won everything. So what on earth are you doing historic racing? And in your case, it's pretty damn obvious because you never stop grinning.
Well, I mean, as I tell people, I got involved in racing as a boy because I was a fan of racing, of the cars, and that never stopped. When I raced as a professional, my love for the sport didn't. It wasn't just a business, you know. I mean, I always
how
loved.
How old were you when you started then, actually racing?
I was 20.
Late started.
Yeah, because in the United States at the time, you had to be 21 to
did
race.
Did you even on a private circuit?
Yeah, I never, no, I mean, we didn't, you know, in those days, at least for me, you know, I was very fortunate, you know, my father raced, as you know, in sports cars and as a hobby, so I got to watch the greatest drivers in the world, particularly in the late 60s, early 70s in the sports car championship, you know, the 917s and what have you, but I never really thought I'd ever drive a race car, and then I got the chance to do it, and thankfully, I found out I was reasonably good at it, so I didn't have to go out and find a real job. but you know, as I said, Rob, you know, my love for the sport, my enthusiasm and interest in it, never changed. Just, you know, when I became a professional, it was just I was fortunate to be able to make a living at it, and at the same time, follow the cars that I always loved, you know, watching.
Bobby, didn't you once tell me your mother had a Porsche, had a 904?
No, she never had a 904. She had 911s and what have you.
I could have sworn there was a 904 in the...
We had a 906. We had
okay.
a Carrera 6. And in fact, I spent many hours underneath that, you know, cleaning it and doing the menial tasks.
You came over to England as a young man trying to ply your trade over here and... Right. Into Formula One. Do you have good memories of those times?
I do. I mean, I certainly would probably do things a little differently now, just because, you know, in those days that you just kind of came over by yourself and tried to make the best of it. And you know, I was pleased that we were able. You know, we ran Formula 3 and we had a lot of good results and competitive in Formula 3. You know, the year of 1978. If you look at who dominated Formula One for the next really decade at least, it was they all, you know, PK was in then, and Derek Warwick, myself, there were some very good drivers that never really quite made it. Anders Olofsson, who I think Jan Lammers won the F3 championship that year, but Olofsson was very, very good, and a French driver named Patrick Gaillard, who was extremely good. And you know, so you got to race against all these great young guys, and Prost was in F3 that year as well. So I loved racing the European circuits, and then I did Formula 2 and the same. So I don't, you know, I wish it would have been a little more successful. You know, I would like to have, you know, we probably didn't quite go about it the way we should have. We were never quite with the best teams, you know, and when you look back in hindsight, you know, you really have to be with the best teams. You know, would Lewis Hamilton be where he is today if he hadn't been groomed by Ron Dennis, you know, from the start and in the best teams at every level of the sport? And you really have to have that. So none of which I had, but I have no regrets. It was a great thrill and made a lot of friends and enjoyed it.
Did you have a test here in Formula 3?
Goodwood? No.
No.
No, because I ran Dallara's first Formula 3 car, so we were based in Italy.
Right.
And drove at a little track there called Verano. That's where we did our testing.
Mm. Yeah.
The car was fabulous at Verano. There was only one problem. There weren't any races at Verano.
I tell you, one of your competitors said to me today, you know what the great thing about being an old racing driver is? The older we get, the faster we were.
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
Very true.
But you know what I loved about it? Just a real quick story if we have the time. You know, I went to Dallara in the spring of 78, I get there, and I don't speak a word of Italian, and nobody there except for Dr. Ingegneri Dallara, he spoke English, but nobody else really did. And I'll never forget, I get in the car, and they tie a rope around the roll bar and to the back bumper of a Fiat 500, and they drag me through town. Out to the circuit. There's no trailer, no phalanx of mechanics. You know, there was like one guy, and he was driving the Fiat. And you'd go out there, and you'd start testing, and pretty soon, after a few laps, you'd see a couple heads on the hillside, you know, people watching, and after about 30 minutes, there'd be a couple more, and an hour later, there'd be, you know, more and more, and probably 2 hours later, I don't think anybody was doing anything in the town other than watching the testing, you know. And to me, that's what it was all about. I love that. You know, and I would never, you know, these people didn't have a lot of money. You go into the little cafe, and I never bought a coffee or a little cake or whatever. They always gave it to you. And that, to me, is what made it all really special.
Yeah.
Particularly in Italy, as you say. I mean, Nigel, you were at Monza last weekend. Yeah. I mean, the feeling, the passion, the atmosphere is just the same in 2010.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I mean, the post-race scenes on Sunday were sort of almost, you're sort of going back to the sort of time of Schechter and Villeneuve.
Yeah.
Because they never showed that sort of passion when Michael won. You know, simply because they admired him, but they never took him to their hearts.
Yeah, no, I must say, I think that the Italians are incredible spectators to have because they are so keen. You know, as a driver, it's wonderful to see people who really are enjoying what you're doing, because after all, we're only actors, really. You know, using a car as a tool of our trade, and they really do appreciate it. It's amazing, amazing.
In fact, the paddock these days at Monza is quite... It's Bernie's influence. It is quite a sort of antiseptic feeling, yeah, compared with what it used to be. But we were reminiscing last weekend about the good old days in the 70s and 80s, and the things the fans would do to get into the paddock.
Mm-hmm.
And we came in, I remember coming in one morning, and the police were just arresting a bunch of people, and they had tunneled under the wire.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't doubt it.
Really?
They had. Well, you know, interesting, another little tidbit, you know, when we, 1985, this is when I guess Enzo was threatening the FIA that he was going to pull out of Formula One and go to IndyCar racing. So the fellow I drove for, Jim Truman, was approached by Leo Mel, who ran Goodyear, and said, would we be interested in running the Ferrari IndyCar? And, of course, that was quite a big, you know, I mean, that was an exciting offer, you know, to Ferrari and Indianapolis car racing. And so we shipped one of my March 85C Indy cars over to Fiorano. And so ostensibly they could copy it, I guess. And I actually tried to get Adrian, because Adrian knew he had been my engineer in 84 and 85. And I tried to get Adrian to come with me. And but he didn't, you know, and he was still working with March. And I think Robin Hurd probably, and you know, gave him a lot of good reasons why he shouldn't go there. And so we went, and we were doing testing. The same thing. I go out to do the first few laps at Fiorano, and you see people, they're hanging on the walls because there wasn't a hillside to sit above, or they've shinnied up telephone poles to, you know, get a glimpse over the wall, because the wall was about at least 20 feet high. And you know, so we watched us do the testing, and I don't think you'd see that anywhere else except Italy.
I mean, this is the stuff. This is why we're all sitting here now. This is why we've all loved it all our lives, isn't it? I mean, it's just. So Sterling, you've got to go. I know you don't know this, but I'm getting signals that you have to leave us now.
I've got to go, because I've got to go and chat people up around the place and try and earn a living, actually. Try and earn a living,
Okay,
going around shaking hands, signing books, you know, that sort of thing. But it is a great occasion, and it's so nice to speak to you.
Yeah.
And look forward to it next year when I'll be a bit older.
Much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Sterling Moss. Doesn't get better than that.
No.
Well, at Goodwood, it doesn't get any better than that, does it? In a few moments, we will have another driver joining us. And yes, you're right, I don't know who it is. But I mean, they're going to come and see us, and then they're going to go, and Bobby's still here. Bobby, this place, Goodwood, you need to be pretty much wide awake, don't you?
I mean, this circuit is so fast, and all the corners tighten up as you, the further, you know, they're all decreasing radius corners. So you can get sucked into these corners, and then all of a sudden you're like, especially as at St. Mary's, I think, in the back, I mean, that one tightens up quite a bit, and you're going quite quick, you know, into approaching that. And you know, even turn one, it's the same thing at double apex, but it's very easy to get in there a little too hot, and then it doesn't want to, you know, of course you're driving somebody else's car all the time too, so you're going, you know, I tell you, there's a lot of pressure, because unfortunately the competitive juices still flow amongst everybody here, and when the flag drops, everybody goes storming off into turn one. And of course, you know, it's, you know, no matter what all the discussion about everybody's supposed to drive like gentlemen, that happens beforehand when the green, when the Union Jack in this case drops, then it's like, my good, you know, it's or actually it goes up, I guess, but anyway, you know, everybody's brain switches off and it's back to the old days. And but this circuit is a very challenging extremely fast circuit, and it's very easy to get into the corners a little too hot.
And not much runoff.
And there's not much run. And the thing about these cars with little tires, and it's once they're on a trajectory, that's pretty much it. It's not like you can turn the wheel a little bit more and they'll turn a little more. I mean, sort of once you're on that line, that's it. So you better make sure you're where you're supposed to be.
Bobby, Goodwood's been a big influence on you with your new enterprise over in the States, the Motor Racing Legends series.
Right.
How's it going?
You know, I think we're a critical success. We're not getting the kind of fields that we'd like to get yet, but I think people are very happy with the organization, and to me, that's first. You know, if we're not doing those things right, then it doesn't matter, you know, what we might say or do afterwards. And so we have our next races at Sebring in December, and I think we're going to have a very good entry there. So pleased about that. And I think the word in the paddocks around the country is very positive. So I think next year we look forward to much better fields.
And is the spirit of Goodwood is what you're trying to achieve over there?
Well, you know, I'd love to. I don't, you know, the spirit maybe. There's no way you can replicate Goodwood. Goodwood is unique. I don't know. I don't care where you would go anywhere in the world. I don't think you could capture everything that you see or feel here. This truly is just a one in a million event. And but there are certain aspects of it that, you know, yes, we would like to embrace. One of which is how the participants are treated and not just having a lot of track time, but being, you know, fed and you know, just the whole entertainment side. You know, it's, about 6 months ago, I said to my wife, I said, you know, I think we're going to take a pass on Goodwood this year. And she goes, well, I don't know. She goes, you might, but I'm going. and that's what you really strive for. You know, if you want to have something your wife or girlfriend wants to go to. And for sure, Lord March has figured that one out.
Okay, well, a man who has won the Le Mans 24-hour race so many times it's almost ridiculous has joined us around the table. And, of course, his name is Tom Christensen. Tom, thank you very much for coming. Fantastic to see you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Tell us about your weekend coming up. I see you studying what I think are practice times there, yeah?
I was just handed them. Yeah, I've been out on the track, and I think it's really a great circuit. Obviously, old school. It's got a lot of camber changes, but very fast. It's faster than I've expected. I had a brief run here on the wet last week before the Silverstone race, and I'm very impressed. But there was not so many people. Now it's like walking back into the 50s, 60s, or whatever. And I must say, this is being a Goodwood novice. I'm really overwhelmed.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, imagine being a novice when you've done everything you've done. Yeah, but of course, I got to ask you really, what made you want to come and do it? Because, you know, like all these guys, you've done everything, and you're still, you know, really in there.
Obviously, this. I mean, I was asked before to come, which I couldn't. It didn't fit. But obviously, this is the heritage of motorsport. This is our heart and soul, and to be able to drive against or in cars, and also sometimes against drivers who drove competitively before I was even born. And this racetrack goes to the 66. I'm born in 67. This is something unique, and this is something which I think, if this is not in your heart and soul, if this is not your interest, then you have no fundamental passion for motorsport. And what I see here, I see passion. I see everyone is in the act. In a way, I see everyone here with a twist in the eye of what they brought on, the clothes or the car they bring out. But I see this is much more than what we do on the racetrack. I mean, the whole paddock is buzzing, and this is what is different to what we do normally and every day, and that's nice.
Good to see you, Tom, here. Goodwood, back in the 50s and 60s, used to hold a round of the World Sports Car Championship. You're competing in what is essentially a world championship now, the new Intercontinental Series. How important do you think it is for sports car racing to have a world championship? Do you consider this new series as a world championship?
Yes, we do, and it is the right way. Certainly for the manufactured and the manufactured back teams. Obviously, the Achilles heel is with private teams, but to make the funding, to make the travel all around the world. But it makes the key, and the Le Mans is the jewel in the crown. It is the race where everyone builds their cars, but we want to race them and go to show them to the public all around the world. So yes, Intercontinental Cup or whatever it's called, it is a world championship in our minds. I guess it's due to rights from FIA or ACO. But the world championship is I absolutely love it. And in a way, I mean, now I didn't hear what you talked with Bobby on before, but obviously the American Le Mans series have done that, and when we did that, the whole world looked onto it or looked at that. They did it really, really well, and of course the European Le Mans series is run at a very high level. But it's basically, if we can combine these elements into the World Series, then it can be really good, because I think you can ask all the drivers you get in these seats and ask. And when they have done sports cars, what if they like that? And I think everyone says yes. Sports cars for sure is what I enjoy most in racing, because you share a car with another driver, you need the respect, you need the camaraderie, and I think that's what is good in sports cars. And sometimes, yes, we love to watch the Formula One races as well, but we are very happy doing the sports cars, and you can do them a little bit longer. And you know, I'm not 25 anymore, but a little bit older than that.
I was just going to say, Tom, I remember a few years ago talking to Martin Brundle about you, and he described you as the great lost Formula One driver. He said, I can remember him saying, Christensen should have been in Formula One years ago. Do you ever feel you...
You know what? I mean, I think any driver, and that's right, he has the ambition to go to Formula One. So a lot of time, that is the focus. But we all know today, and with hindsight, we all know there's a lot more to motorsport than Formula One. And I'm not saying I have tried hard in previous years. I've even talked to Bobby at some stage. You can ask him about that. But obviously, I have been thereabouts. But it's difficult for Dane. I have never had any backing of significance. So what I realize is I have to drive for people who wants me to drive the cars. But, and this has been great. I'm looking back of fantastic years. And if I made it to Formula One a few times, there has been some little opportunities. I might not have had the luck and success I've had, especially with Audi, because the signing with Audi is, of course, for me a fantastic opportunity. Sure. So in that sense, you need the goals and the ambition to motivate yourself to do well when you're in a race car. And sometimes other people get picked, but it's perfect. I think the Formula One today, I think you have more or less all the right drivers in at the moment. And obviously, I know I'm far too old now. But yes, I would love to have gone, but I'm very happy with not.
You're only 2 years older than Schumacher.
Yes.
Bobby, Tom came to see you. Just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think it was probably around 2000. It came down to between Tom and Kenny Breck to take over the shell car from Brian Herta. And Tom had come very highly recommended by a lot of people, and as had Kenny. And we spoke. Actually, probably Tom should thank me for not hiring him, because he never would have won Le Mans eight times, right? But... in the end, I went with Kenny only really because at the time he'd had oval experience, and you know, not whether
you did the right choice.
Not whether Tom could do it or not, because for sure Tom would have been able to.
No, but it's a pleasure. I've been at his workshop in Ohio, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, so that's why I always get a thrill when I see Tom do so well, because. That's kind of funny. You know, in 2001, I think I came very close to hiring Heinz Held Frentzen. We met several times.
Yeah. That's right.
And I'll never forget, he wins the French Grand Prix. So I sent him a cable that said, "Aren't you glad I didn't hire you now?" I think Tom would then, he'd be successful no matter what it is. And you know, I think there's probably a lot of guys who either just dabbled in Formula One or never got there that could have been very successful had all the moons aligned and the planets and what have you. Because, as we know, it's not always clear why somebody's where they are.
Okay, well done, you guys. We now welcome to the motorsport table Martin Brundle. I don't think Martin needs much introduction, only to say that he's probably a bigger name now than he was when he was in Formula One, in a very different way of life. But it's been a hugely successful for you, hasn't it?
Well, the TV's gone very well, yeah. It's sort of a second career. I've been very lucky, and to the extent where I often describe my racing career as a fact-finding mission for my television career. But that's the way it's turned out. But I still get a lot of pleasure. I mean, it's really interesting for me, this four-week break that we just had in Formula One. About 2.5 weeks in, I was just itching, ready to go. I wanted to go back racing, and I was missing it quite badly. So, especially with the great championship year we're having at the moment, it's so exciting. So, I think I've done 27 years now of F1, and well over 400 races. I was talking to Roger Benoit the other day, the Swiss journalist. He's just doing his 600th Grand Prix. Mm. I thought I'd been to a lot of races. Yeah. So, but I do enjoy it a lot. Mm.
Well, Benoit 600, you say?
Yeah, apparently.
Wow.
Oh,
you're not going to trump.
No, I'm not. No, I've done about 535, something like that. No, I'm not near Benoit. And in fact, Jabby Cronbach was well over 600.
Is that right?
It's
a lot of air miles.
This season of all seasons, though, we were just saying before we came on air that to win the World Championship this year is going to be so special, because what a season it's been. It's just so tight.
It is, and you're right. And I think we've got a lot of excitement to come, yeah, with the night race of Singapore, on a bumpy track and a street layout, then the unpredictable tracks of Suzuka, where the weather can be strange. It'll be the same in Brazil. We go to Korea in between. Nobody knows that. Abu Dhabi might be a bit more predictable. So we've got a grand finale to what's been a brilliant season. All five of them get up every morning and think they're going to win the World Championship this year. And I do admire them, especially Monza, you know, Vettel, Alonso and Button, the guys who really had to get their season back on course, all got the job done. So with the point system the way it is, it's all to play for. I have no idea who's going to win the title. You'd think that the advantage that Hamilton and Webber have got, and even after Monza, would be enough to give them a comfort zone. But I think that Alonso, Vettel and Button can afford to take risks and just go for gold. And sometimes that pays off, as we all know. Yeah, so who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. I was just going to say, one thing that interests me is that you've taken the trouble or been able to drive some of these modern cars to keep you up to speed in your current job. And sometimes we hear, you know, they are very, very tricky to drive. People say they look easy to drive on television. But, you know, they're very, very, very different from your day, aren't they?
Well, in many respects, they're a lot easier to control. You can't miss a gear. You really have to struggle to lock a brake. And they pretty much react to your mind. Whatever you think you want to do next, the car's ready to do. They turn in brilliantly. They stick like hell in the fast corners. And even now, I think I could quite quickly get to within 2 or 3 seconds per lap of a competitive time until my neck fell off. I think I did 37 laps in a Williams a couple of years back, and I was destroyed for about 2 days. Physically, they beat you up. But it's, as ever, it's that last second or so that's really hard to do. And, you know, jumping in a set-up Formula One car is easy. Somebody else has set it up. So you've got to work with the team, work your tyres, understand the race, think about the race. There's so much to it. And as it is with any high-level motorsport, any high-level sport, I suspect, that it's not just about the raw lap time. Fundamentally, the cars are so much better than the ones I raced in Formula One. They're a dream to drive, and they don't bite you, really. But, get them very close to the ragged edge, and that's where the skill comes in.
You use that is also how you go into the Austin A35 today? That's with the same mindset?
Yeah, I've got such a weekend. I had a seat fitting in my two. I always said I'd never come in unless I could test the car, which I've tested neither of them. And I got out of a 250 GTO Ferrari worth north of $20 million, apparently. And you sit on sort of on that almost, looking down on the bonnet. And then I got into this A35 worth something less than $20 million, presumably. And you sit on the floor. I couldn't see out of it. It was quite a good little car. Actually, I realised you don't need the brakes. You just turn in, and I'll be quicker next time. We're fifth on the grid. It's going to be, you're second on the grid, I think, aren't you? Yeah, your car. Yeah.
It does look very much a 2010 A35, Martin.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what an A35. It's the first car I ever had when I was 8 years old. We used to go around a field as soon as we could blag one of my dad's mechanics out of the workshop to take us. And my brother used to kneel on the seat, and I could drive it and look through the steering wheel. And that's pretty much how I felt today, actually. It took me back to being 8 years old.
Well, I think I speak for everyone when I say I think it's truly fantastic that guys like you come and do this. Really fun. The crowd love it. Everyone loves it. So thank you to all of you. We're joined now by some trouble. Mr. Jochen Mass is here. He's a busy man this weekend too. Thank you very much, Tom Christensen. Thank you. Jochen driving three cars, busy man. Two busy men here, Martin Brundle and Jochen Mass, actually. And Jochen, you're in the TT in a DB4 GT Aston Martin, which is not going to win the race, but great car for you to have.
Don't talk it down before we start it, please. No, I've never driven an Aston Martin, so I was really looking forward to do that finally. And luckily somebody heard my sort of outcry from the backlands and, called me up and he said, you can drive with me. So that's nice. I really look forward to it. I believe it's a lovely car. You had more experience with it, right? With the Aston Martin DB4.
Yeah, it's a nice car. So it's quite nicely balanced. It's not going to bite you too much, but I don't think it depends which one it is. I don't think it's the fastest car here, is it? No. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of titanium and carbon fiber in like some of the others.
Yeah, no, exactly. It weighs about 1,200 kilos, so it's more on the heavy end. But you know, if you come from a Mercedes sort of situation, then everything is light. You know, Mercedes is by nature slightly on the heavy end, but that's the way it was.
This circuit's bitten you in the past, hasn't it? You had quite a nasty accident here in the Lancia Ferrari.
You did, right in front of me.
I can't remember. I don't want to talk about it.
No, but honestly, it frightened the hell out of me. You know, just...
Oh, it did?
Jesus. It did.
Okay.
It did.
Out of me,
I
too.
To I s-
the funny thing was...
1956 Formula One car upside down.
Yeah, no, it wasn't very good. No. I was hoping, while I was sort of going towards it, that it wouldn't happen like that. And... you know, it was really a stupid situation because if you stand on the brake and on the throttle at the same time, the more you brake, the more you accelerate. And I couldn't extract my foot in time. So then I thought I go straight through the chicane. But then for a moment I thought there's still a piece of brick wall in it. But of course there wasn't. But I couldn't remember exactly. So I thought rather not take that risk. Try one way or the other, you know. So I spun on the grass and so on and fell over. Didn't do much damage. And, my back is still sometimes a little bit less flexible than it might have been otherwise. But, these things happen, unfortunately, and it's a bit stupid. It shouldn't happen, and it's really... but it went well, so I can't complain.
You got a neck like a rugby player, thankfully, haven't you? But and it strangled you, didn't it? The crash helmet sort of was cutting off
your
ear.
Yeah, because the back end of my helmet, while I skidded backwards, scooped up a lot of earth, grass, So it was pushed forward and the strap strangled my windpipe completely. And it's a bit silly because you know you don't have much time left before you go unconscious. And so I was putting my hand out gingerly, trying to persuade somebody to lift the car so I could actually get my head forward. But, or backwards rather. And it didn't happen. So I pulled it off my head. Luckily it was an open face helmet. And I pulled it off my head and it worked. You know, I was quite heavily bruised after that. But nevertheless, you know, in desperation, you manage.
I'm interested to know, we're celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain and we've got the Spitfires here. As a good German, Jochen, how does that feel, sitting in the driver's mess here?
Well, thanks for rubbing it in. It's the most impressive sight of Goodwood revival, the planes here. I really love them. You know, I look at them as... not as fighting machines, perhaps, as you do, perhaps, you know, coming from the island. But, I look at them as pieces of brilliant.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Engineering, flying machines, you know, brilliantly engineered flying machines. And that's great. I flew with one. I was lucky enough to go around with Nigel Lamb once. And so on, they're highly impressive. And it's a wonderful sight here to see them all the time. I do not necessarily feel all that comfy when it's sort of emphasized on, you know, coming to our driver's club. I said, this is not a driver's club, this is a war club, you know, with all these sort of pointers, you know, towards what you shouldn't do and what you should definitely avoid, you know, being with Germans. So therefore, it's a bit peculiar. But then again, of course, I understand. It is, as always, sort of a key, a focus point of somebody's life. You know, a war. It's the most hideous thing which can happen. And yet, of course, it leaves you for all your life once you've been in it, and you suffer through it one way or the other. You know, probably our parents, of course, more than us, luckily, and so on. So I understand this point of view. I understand the emotions behind it and all that. That's, of course, pretty clear. But, you know, being a German, you know, I'm also glad that it ended the way it ended. We would have not been any better had it been the other way around, that's for sure.
And just bringing things back to the modern day, being a German, what's the reaction at home to Vettel this year? Because the way things are going, he's looking more and more like Michael Schumacher, like a young Michael Schumacher again. What's the press reaction in the public?
Is that perceived as good or bad? I'm assuming that's
bit of,
good.
Bit of both, I think, maybe?
Yeah, a bit of everything, yes.
No, I think Vettel, every driver has a different character. And I think Vettel is a complete different person to Michael. And I think he drives different, and he approaches racing differently, and so on. So I think he's a lighter kid, let's say, than perhaps Michael was in the same stage of his life. And I think he's very, very well perceived. Michael became very popular because of his fantastic successes, you know, to win 7 titles, something else. But, you know, he was never really perceived as Mr. Nice Guy. Even in Germany, everybody liked him for his success, but they always had some sort of misgivings for one or the other character traits which he occasionally displayed, which was sometimes unjust, sometimes it was correct, and so on. So he was a difficult person, perhaps. And, you know, he is maturing. We talked about it earlier. He is maturing now, you know, through age. And the first time now that I heard him in an interview admitting that he cannot be in the same sort of speed league as the young guys. So that's a new side to him, which we haven't seen so far.
Okay, Martin Brundle's about to leave us, A, because he probably wants some lunch, and B, because we have Richard Atwood waiting in the wings. But Martin, I just wanted to mention one quick thing, and that is that Bernie Ecclestone says that Sebastian Vettel will be the world champion.
This year, or at some point. I've no doubt he'll be a world champion at some point. I'm full of admiration. I love the way he drives. I love his mentality. I love his style with the media. No other driver thanks the cameraman and soundman before he leaves. And everybody in the paddock admires him. He's a bit impetuous, there's no doubt about it. His speed and skill is unquestioned. I see him as Lewis Hamilton 2 years ago, frankly. I see the speed and commitment without the control. And quite clearly, Sebastian loses his head a little bit under pressure. We've seen that so many times this year already. But if Bernie means this year, then I think it's a tall order for him. But not impossible. If he means in the future, then I think it's a guarantee.
And the odd thing is he's made more mistakes this year than he did last, hasn't he?
I think because last year he threw away a potential championship, and I think he put it down to, well, I might have won it, but for a few mistakes here and there. This year he expected the championship, and I think that pressure is a strange thing, isn't it, Jochen? We've all been through it. And it does strange things with your body and your mind under in a racing car, as in anything else in life, under pressure. And that is a question of how you, you know, the pressure is either going to burn you and bury you or give you energy and lift you.
Okay, well, if you'd like to hear some more from Martin Brundle, you only have to wait about 5 days. Five or six days, and he will be back on BBC television in Singapore. Thank you, Martin. And our next guest, Mr. Richard Attwood. Richard, thank you very much. Richard Attwood, probably one of the most loyal Goodwood supporters of them all, and will be famous to many of you for the superb victories here at Goodwood in the BRM. Since we've been staging the revival meeting, but of course before that, also a Grand Prix driver. Richard, this weekend, tell us about what you're racing, first of all.
Well, I have four races. The Saloon, yes, and Falcon, but not the big one, the midi one. It's a six-cylinder one, so I've driven that already this morning. The other three I haven't. It's in the Dino 246, what I call the Hawthorne-type car. And the BRM, which I've owned with Michael Ostromoff for the last several years, which hasn't run well for a long time, but we're fingers crossed in that one. 366 rear-engine Grand Prix cars. And I'm in a Cobra with a guy here for the first time in the TT. Yeah. So it's a busy Sunday, I think.
You guys are busier than you were when you were, aren't you?
Well, but you know, I mean, in the old days, I mean, Stirling would do all the races in a day, wouldn't he? So, you know, things haven't changed in that respect. I mean, it's possible to drive more, but four is probably a bit too much, but it keeps me busy, yeah.
Richard, back in the 60s, you know, racing drivers drove on so many different types of circuit. Goodwood was an airfield circuit. How was it rated by the drivers back then in terms of all the different other circuits that you were racing on?
Safety-wise, you're talking about?
No, just in terms of as a racing circuit, as a challenge.
No, it was, I think, Goodwood is a fantastic circuit. I mean, it was, when you think it was just a perimeter track around an airfield, how it's turned out is just amazing. And Tony Gaze is here this weekend, and it was his idea that he suggested to the Duke that, you know, maybe they could make a track here. And the corners are just they're medium high speed, and these old cars are really on the move. You know, if you go on the outside of the track here, you'll see everybody who's really on it. They're working quite well. So how did it compare with other tracks? I don't know, really. I mean, it was all the tracks were dangerous anyway. If you talk about dangerous tracks, as Spa and Nürburgring, to me, were the ones that, when I left there, I clasped my hands together and looked to the sky, because they, you know, if you went off on either of those tracks in those days, you're going to be severely injured, if nothing worse. And Spa is probably the worst of the lot, and I'm not talking about the Spa as it is now, of course.
Well, I drove around the old Spa when I was there 3 or 4 weeks ago, the part of it that remains. And every time I do it, and I do it every year, and every time, I still have the same sort of feeling. Through, you know, Bournaville, and then the Master Kink and so
on. Yeah.
And you just think...
Yeah. Well, there's some of it's not there now. I mean, the Master Kink was a huge corner where the flags were, and then down that straight. But, I mean, it was all at such high speed.
Yeah.
I mean, an incident there, there were bridges and... of lampposts and telegraph poles and things. Well, I mean, I went off there and I hit a telegraph pole, but fortunately for me, the car slowed down quite a lot by that time, but the car caught fire and it was quite dramatic. And I could have easily become another statistic right there.
Yeah.
Could you take the Master King flat with the old Formula cars?
I think we were in 1.5 litre cars, so I think it was in 65 I was there. Yes, almost certainly, I'm sure it was. The 3 litre cars, I can't really remember, to be honest. But the 917s went there as well, and they obviously would not be flat because they were aerodynamically, you know, went through the air quite a bit faster, so not. But I remember it being flat from Stavelo back up to La Source. I think that section most cars was pretty much
flat. No, the fast left-hander was not quite flat.
No, is it not? Just before La Source, yes. But a lot of it was flat out. So, top speed the whole time. So, and, of course, the average speed was way off the scale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Jochen, for you, Spa or Nürburgring, what was better and more scary?
Well, I mean, the Nürburgring was in some way safer. Sounds a bit silly, but the old Spa was a treacherous circuit. I loved it. I really loved it because it was very, you know, exhilarating, and it was really amazing. But it was damn hairy. When we drove it in, when we won the 24 hours in 72, we lost four people in the night. Mm. So there was Joisten and three Alpha, two Alphas in the night, and then one in the morning, and so on and so on. And I wondered why we should do that. Mm. You know, just take these sort of risks. And of course, a marshal was killed in a Master King, who was run over by a Master on top of it. And so it was a difficult thing to swallow at the time. You know, we were considering safety a little bit more important than perhaps previously. So, but Nürburgring was, because of its sheer nature, it wasn't quite as quick, you know, in most sections. There was a very fast Antonius Buche and all that after long straight, before you get down to the dip and back to the, you know, now the chicane. Of course, then it was still quite flat. You had a bit of a left, right, left again past the start and finish line.
Yes. Leading up to start. Yeah. I mean, that was the only fast bit, really, wasn't it? The straight was
that
really
was terribly
fast.
Quick.
Yeah.
And so on. But the others were more sort of corners, which were exciting, you know. Mm. It was a great track. I mean, we knew, because it was, you know, in the 60s, there were no guardrails, nothing. There were just the hedges, really. And, of course, that was hairy enough. But on the other hand, remarkably little really happened at this strange circuit.
Well, I mean, I don't know when you first drove there, but in the first...
68.
Now, had they done the surface improvement at all then or not? No, because I remember the roads very cambered and just driving in a straight line was very difficult. And the first car I drove there was the Shelby Cobra in 64. And that was just the most diabolical car because of the surface. And I remember taking off, literally four wheels off the ground, 20 to 30 times a lap, which just doesn't happen now because, it's been sanitized with the surface. Yeah. But it was narrow, and overtaking was very, very difficult because of that. And the cambers were very, very
critical. I didn't know it like that. Sure, there must have been.
No, it was really, really bad. And they were the two circuits that I feared the most.
But I remember even with a 962 or 956 with a Porsche, I could look at my rev counter exactly twice a lap. You couldn't watch your instruments. You were so busy trying to keep the car on the road. It was amazing. Mm. And there was sort of, you know, I mean, the Formula One was, by comparison, beautiful.
Yes, but that's whether you had a certain amount of downforce with those cars, which, of course, we didn't have at all.
Yeah, we had too much downforce, perhaps.
Well, maybe. I didn't experience that. Keeps you on the ground, though.
Yeah, not everywhere, so. And especially when it wears out a little bit. Spoke to Beloff, because we were driving at the same sort of stints. And different car, so, and I started to fly at the Flansgarten jump in the back. And I told him, I said, watch it, when your underbody is worn a little bit, you know, you lose some of the downforce and you may fly there. He said, sure. And he did fly, big time.
Mm. He didn't land in time to take the right-hander. Yeah. Well.
I'm interrupting because we've been joined now by Manuele Pirro, who you may have read his interview in the very latest edition of Motorsport magazine. I hope you have read it, and if you did, I hope you enjoyed it. But Manuele, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you. Have you had your lunch?
Yeah, first of all, my pleasure. Thank you. I had my lunch, and actually I'm a little bit feeling strange because I just flew from the U.S., through the night and got to Heathrow in the morning, drove straight to the hotel. Room was not ready. I'm not complaining. I'm really happy boy, but room was not ready. I changed in the bathroom and rushed into the paddock, sign on in a real split second and jump into a car that I never saw before. And this is, if I ever write a book, you know, I'm going to advise exactly not to do what I've done today. But unfortunately, the call and the passion of motor racing is so strong, and I couldn't avoid being in Washington, D.C. last night, but I couldn't miss Goodwood. So here
I am. Yeah, but that's the Roman way. I mean, you did a lot in history, which you shouldn't have done. So that's okay.
Thank you, Jochen. Well, anyway, it's tough at the top, isn't it?
No, it's. I mean, this is now becoming a habit for me. Goodwood, it's an event that I have to have a very, very, very good reason to miss it. And every year, you feel more and more home. and every year you want to come back again. And and you know, life is short, and it doesn't give you so many opportunities of being around in the environment that we all love, and seeing all the people that you know. Friendship is a big word, but there's a lot of people that you feel close to them, even if you see them once or twice a year, because you're sharing the same passion, you're sharing the same risks, you're sharing the same life, and a lot of the people of these people you meet in Goodwood. So it's really great to be here.
We thought we'd seen the last of you in terms of international racing after you parted ways with Audi, but you're enjoying a new lease of life now with the Lola in the LMS. And how is it driving as a privateer?
This is a good question, and you know, it's difficult sometimes to script your life. And at one stage, Audi was actually, since a long time ago, they were thinking of you know, ending our generation of drivers and renewing it. But we kept delivering results. But at a certain stage, I made an agreement with them, and they said, okay, at the end of 08, whatever happens is going to be my last season. They offered me a nice contract as a brand ambassador, so to, let's say, give a reason of the 16 years of partnership and success we had together. And I said, okay, that's a good opportunity, I take it. But then I didn't really take into account my strong passion, and so I felt really bad staying at home. Although my life is really full, thank God, of other commitments, and there's a lot of work, and I really have a problem to find time. But still, the time you spend in a race car, the adrenaline that gives you, especially the sports cars, which they're really fast cars, and they are so nice to drive, you know, they really give you strong feelings. I felt maybe I didn't make the right decision. And sometimes, you know, if you're an optimistic guy, the right door opens exactly at the right time. And I got a call from Lord Drayson asking if I could join them as a third driver in their car. And I called Audi, and Dr. Rurik, he knows how much I want to drive. And he said, yeah, you can do it. Lola is not a brand competitor of Audi. And I thought about it, and I said, what should I do? It's a private car, so it's a new life for me in a way. But now I'm not racing for money, I just race for passion. And I just gathered information, and I was told the Lola is a good car, the team is a healthy team, why not? And I went to do the first race this year in Sebring, and maybe some of you recall the first 2 hours of race where I was giving a very hard time to the Peugeot, even passing one on the race, and I felt like I was a kid. The enthusiasm I had, and you know, you couldn't see the smile because I had a closed face helmet on top of it. I had a roof, but I thought, this is where I want to be still. You know, it was too early, and so this has been a tremendous opportunity for me to keep back into racing. I consider, you know, I drew a line of my career, so whatever happens now is just a bonus. It's a sure. gift. You know, so it's a good way to look at it.
Fantastic, Richard. We must let you go. Because I know you've got other things to do apart from four races this weekend. But before you go, just tell me quickly, BRM, it's a big weekend this weekend for BRM. We're doing a special BRM tribute. And sum up for me your feelings about BRM's good and bad, because...
Well, I suppose I was lucky in a way, because I drove BRMs in their good era. And so it was from around sort of 65... Well, I had a BRM engine 64 on the back of a Lotus BRM, but the era was good, and it was between the 1.5 and 3 litres. So I drove both, and I think with the monocoque cars, they were always regarded, I think, as very safe cars, and you know, not many people got hurt in a BRM, and things also didn't fall off them, and they had a lot of support in around that. The 60s era was good for them, I think. But before that, it was very bad. With the V16, and then of course they made a similar mistake with the 816, and there was a lot of messing around, a lot of wasted energy and money, I think, but they got it right in the end, and their first result was with a straightforward four cylinder engine. So that probably sort of showed them a little bit that an overcomplication of mechanical things is not a good thing. But they had success into the 70s as well. So they've had grey areas and good bits, and I was a part of the good bit, I suppose. So I was lucky to be there then.
Manueli, Richard obviously was the first driver to win Le Mans for Porsche back in 1970 with the 917. I always thought you were a driver that would have thrived in any era. How would you have fancied racing at Le Mans in those cars?
I was actually lucky enough to be the first driver to win for Audi, and this is, you have a one-off opportunity, because the second year is you're not going to be the first, and in a race like this you need a lot of luck. I always, after every win I had, I always thought this is a gift, because there's many places where you can lose a race like this, but there is no secret to win it. You just have to be there and hang on and just be lucky. So I admire Richard, because he's doing four races this weekend, and I consider my two races already quite a commitment. I consider myself as a driver in between the, say, two eras, because of course I belong to kind of a modern era, although I drove Le Mans first time 31 years ago, so it was already, you can call it history already. But I feel, as a personality, I feel a driver of the past in a way, and I really admire those people who probably saw. It was another time. There was a lot of risk involved, and it was a romantic time, and there was maybe more respect for each other. You knew every mechanic's name, because now in a team, in a big team, you don't even know the names of all your mechanics. And I would have really loved to be born maybe 20 years before and take part to this great time, which I think it's now the foundation of the modern motorsport. So I consider myself a late old arrival of the old drivers.
But you may not be here.
yeah, that's right.
You drove the Auto Union, didn't you?
Yes, I drove them. I drove them. But actually, I don't think the old cars are more difficult than the new cars. I think the places they were racing were horrible. Crazy. Actually, I think a car, the less grip you have, the easier the car is to drive, because it slides and it gives you good warnings. You know, now in the modern cars, the car is glued to the ground until the moment where it snaps off. But what was really difficult at the time, I think every mistake was extremely expensive, and the roads, the runoffs, and the whole approach was so much more dangerous that made everything more difficult. But in terms of actually driving the cars, and actually this is a question I would like to know Richard's opinion, I don't really think that the old cars were more difficult. I think it was much more dangerous, because there were trees, the races were longer, and so many other reasons.
Yes, I think it's if you have barriers and Armco, you have a glancing blow, but if you hit a tree or something like that, it's going to stop straight away. But the cars were much more fragile. But as you say, the circuits were way too dangerous in the first place. And Jackie Stewart's quest to make racing safer was very admirable. He didn't get any support from any of us at the time. We thought, well, if you don't want to race the way things are, well, don't bother to race. But he was absolutely right. He really was, and he got very little thanks for it, I think, from other drivers. But he took it in the right direction.
But actually, No, I think nowadays, and I hope not to be misunderstood, I think races are too safe. I would like a mistake to be more expensive, not for the health of the driver, but now you can go off and rejoin without even losing time. I was actually in the last Grand Prix in Monza in the stewards' room to learn how to be a steward, because I will be a steward in the last Grand Prix. So drivers were cutting through the chicane, and the stewards were saying, okay, he hasn't gained anything, so that's okay. But there was one who went straight twice to defend his position.
Falkenberg.
Yes,
Falkenberg.
And for me, this is no good. If you make a mistake, you have to pay for the mistake. Yeah. Not to pay with your life or with your broken bones, but I think now you can dare too much. And it, in a way, it makes your life a little bit easier, because, you know, at least you have to have a puncture or something if you overshoot the braking.
It was a little bit like at Hockenheim, where you've got turn one there and there's massive runoff on the outside there, and all the drivers very early on were doing that, and somebody made the comment that if there was a brick wall there instead of the white line, they might think a bit more about it. And I think that's what you're talking about, really.
Yeah. Absolutely. And actually, when you see the statistics, in the most dangerous and difficult corners, very few accidents happen because, you know, drivers are scared to go to the maximum. And there are corners we witnessed where in the old days there was barriered all along, and you would really respect them. The same corner became a safe corner, and it's just less of a thrill, less of a challenge to go through, although the corner hasn't changed, just because it's your health and your car is not in jeopardy. And I said before, I hope not to be misunderstood, I don't want to see drivers being hurt, but I would like to see mistakes being
punished.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I was just talking about something else about Le Mans when I did it. Well, when I was a corporate guest at Audi some years ago, and I've been one or two times since, and I just cannot believe that the cars are driven the way they are, flat out. They're bulletproof. When we drove the 917s, we had to manage the car, and you know, we could actually miss a gear. And there's an awful lot has changed from the driver's point of view, in that you know, you can just hammer the car and the car lasts. But if you've done that with a 917, I don't care, you know, how the condition of the car was at the start of the race, it wouldn't last 6 or 7 hours. It would just break. And so that's an added bit that I think we had to do more than you do. But maybe, Emanuele, you actually had to manage your car as well or not?
No, not nowadays. And actually, when I did Le Mans once in 1981 with the Works Lancia, and I remember we had to back off three times on the long straight to let the turbo, excuse me, whatever, cool down. And I think in those days you have to have a very good trust in your teammate, because of course lap time has always been important, but backing off and respecting the car meant giving away some tenths or sometimes seconds of your lap time. And I think the trust you had to have on your teammate must have been even higher than now, because everybody wants to shine, and in order to shine you can abuse to the car. And in fact, I always believed in a really good relationship between teammates, and in my old touring car days, I've been driving with Roberto Ravaglia for many, many years in my sports car with Frank Bila. And I think a good secret of a success is really trusting your teammate, not wanting to beat him every time you go out in practice. You have to be a little bit altruist, accept that he can shine once better than you, you know, so you can share better the track time and set up the car better and do an ever better result. And this is one of the things that the juniors have more problems to understand, because they want to see them quickest every time they go out, and this can put in jeopardy the result of the race.
Emanuele Pirro, Richard Atwood, thank you so much. Well, we have a bit of an exceptional few minutes coming up with Adrian Newey and Christian Horner from the Red Bull Formula One team. Christian's a bit keen to study his practice times, I think. But anyway, let me get the ball rolling on the Goodwood side. I mean, look, guys, it's fantastic that you both come here. I got to ask you, why? It's your weekend off. You're going to Singapore any minute now.
It's a great weekend. I mean, there's some fantastic cars here. It's a privilege to drive, you know, a couple of them. And, you know, it's just, you know, awesome to see so many collectors' cars doing what they should do, which is, you know, running around a racetrack. So, you know, Charles puts on a brilliant event, and it's always a highlight of the calendar.
Adrian, I think we know why you come. You're a frustrated Formula One driver, aren't you?
Certainly not frustrated Formula One driver. Arguably a frustrated driver, but no, for me it's a hobby which I enjoy. I mean, people have said, surely this is a busman's holiday, but in truth, being involved in Formula One professionally, in my case as an engineer, compared to driving cars, which I love and have a great affinity for from when I was a boy, is a very different thing. It's, yes, they're both four wheels, but that's the only thing in common.
These are wonderful prizes for your success, aren't they? I mean, a Ford GT40, it doesn't get a lot better than that. And it just looks, sounds, and to me seems to handle beautifully, yeah?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an iconic car. It's a car which made a big impression on me when I was a lad. So to be in the privileged position where I can own one now, occasionally race it, drive it on the road. My kids love going in it, pick them up from school in it. So it's just a great all-round car.
What about the brakes, Adrian? Because anybody who ever raced one in the car's heyday always said, you know, love the car, but the brakes were the...
Yeah, I mean, it's the downside of the GT40 is it's a heavy car. It's 900 plus kilos. Yeah. And in 1965 spec, which is how we race them here, then it's unventilated discs. So stopping is a bit of a handful.
Christian, you're not in something quite so glamorous. Tell us what you'll be handling.
I've got a bit of a mixture, actually. So technically, I don't think I'm racing. I'm just going round in an Aston Martin DB4 with Tom Alexander, which is a lovely car. I'm in a Sunbeam Rapier that had a little carburetor problem this morning, but still great fun to drive. And I've been asked by John Surtees to drive one of his Formula 2 cars, which you know, is again a great little car.
When was the last time we heard people in Formula 1 mention the word carburetor? I can't remember hearing the word carburetor. Anyway, it's good to
go to any NASCAR race even now.
Well, yes, okay. Finally, on the Goodwood thing, you say you're going round. Well, we know Adrian doesn't just go round. We have evidence of that. Don't you all, once the flag drops, you're going for it, aren't you?
Well, Adrian's reigning champion at this event, so you know, obviously the pressure's all on him this weekend. whereas, you know, obviously with myself, it's, you know, I'm not even semi-professional. So it's just it's good fun. I remember the first time I did this event, I out-qualified Stirling Moss, at which point they announced it was his 74th birthday that day, which put it a little into perspective. And I was amazed how hard some of the guys, you know, push the cars out there. And you've got a lot of, you know, fantastic drivers as well. You know, guys like, you know, Pirro, Gounon, you know, a lot of, you know, very, very quick guys. So, you know, Adrian's going to have his hands full this weekend.
Yeah, no, so I think the TT, I haven't looked at the grid, but I see Tom Christensen's in it. I mean, the grid is staggering. So I shall try to keep my nose clean and not let Bobby down too much.
Are you doing the first stint?
We haven't got that far. Yeah, draw straws on Saturday evening.
Briefing later tonight.
I was going to mention team orders, but perhaps I won't.
There's plenty of team orders here.
Well, I was a bit disappointed the Surtees didn't have a radio, actually, because I was just behind Christian, so I wanted to say that the car behind is quicker.
And you'd have had to say I'm sorry as well, of course. Okay, I'm going to hand over to my colleagues, my editor and my editor-in-chief, for just a very few minutes on the current state of the World Championship 2010.
Well, it seemed to me last weekend was looked as though it was going to be a McLaren weekend, didn't it? I mean, I think that was what most people, we went there thinking that. And that being so, I mean, Lewis's mistake on the first lap, you couldn't really have dreamt of anything better, could you?
No, I think to be fair, it always annoys me when you see people taking great pleasure in somebody else's misfortune. And whilst, you know, I think it was obviously a shame for Lewis that he dropped out in the first lap. Mm. For us, it was a bit of a relief, for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was just, you know, if it had happened at... I mean, the sort of thinking is that from now on, most of the circuits are going to suit Red Bull very well. And that was really, in some ways, that was perhaps McLaren's last shot, where they had a, you know, a discernible advantage over you.
That's the thinking, but, I mean, the truth is that the pace of development of the cars is huge. You can never take anything as guaranteed. McLaren will be bringing new parts to their car. We'll be trying to do the same, but if there's a worth more performance or there's a wet race that just throws up some idiosyncrasies, whatever it might be, so nothing's guaranteed. I think it's the pace of development is what really singles out Formula 1 now.
Well, I think the thing about Monza is if you'd have offered us those points prior to the weekend, we'd have, you know, we'd have probably bitten your arm off for it. So to come out of Monza, you know, actually having outscored McLaren, all the drivers have had incidents, you know, this year, but to be leaving Europe, you know, having actually extended, albeit very brief, you know, very slightly, the advantage to McLaren was, you know, very positive for the team. So makes the last five, you know, going to be scintillating races.
Christian, Mark looked pretty annoyed after the race and having to deal with Hülkenberg in front of him, and the, you know, Hülkenberg didn't get penalised. Stewards' consistency seems about as good as Premiership football referees at the moment. What's your view of it? Did you think that he should have been called in for a penalty?
I think yes. I mean, we certainly were speaking and to you know, the race director through the race, because we felt that, you know, Hülkenberg on more than one occasion took advantage of you know, using extra parts of the circuit, and you know, there was an incident with Alguersuari who was penalised, you know, immediately, and it just seemed to, unfortunately, not consistent, and it was, you know, frustrating for Mark because he spent an awfully large amount of, you know, the second half of the race looking at the gearbox of Nico Hülkenberg, and you know, he eventually did manage to pass, but you know, obviously that then limited his opportunity to have a go at Rosberg. But you know, it's frustrating that sometimes the stewards do seem to be a little inconsistent. We had it, you know, the previous race in Spa, where, you know, it was a, quite an aggressive move on Seb, you know, at the top of the hill, you know, after Eau Rouge, we put on the grass at 300 kilometres an hour. But you know, on the whole, I think this year they have done a better job. But occasionally, you do get these inconsistencies.
Was Mark's problem on the slow getaway on Sunday, was that in any way similar to what happened at Spa? Was did he just get it wrong? I mean, at Spa he was adamant he had a clutch problem.
I think Spa, and I wondered, Adrian, if can correct me if I'm wrong, Spa was out of his control. That wasn't anything to do with him. You know, the start in Monza, you know, wasn't great. Ended up getting a little bit too much wheel spin. Ended up short shifting, and in fairness, they only lost one place on the way down to the first turn, which was with Hamilton. The majority of his places were lost going a little bit too deep into turn one, and then out of the chicane.
Right.
You know, a queue of cars managed to get past them.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I think we have to leave it there. We don't want to leave it there, but thank you so much for giving us your time. You are under pressure, Mr. Newey, as you've heard from your team boss. And Mr. Horner, have a lot of fun. And thank you both very, very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, I'm very, very sad to say that we have to leave it there for this month's podcast, partly because these racing drivers have many, many things to do today and tomorrow and the day after. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we all did here. Goodbye from Nigel Roebuck, from Damien Smith, and from myself. Before we go, I really must thank the Goodwood Road Racing Company and the Earl of March for allowing us to use their Rolex Drivers Club for this podcast. It's been a fantastic event for us. I hope it has been for you. And also to thank Ed Foster and Gabriella, who have been bringing our guests to us like clockwork. Wonderful work. And never forget Alan Hyde, who controls the sound. And I can assure you that today, controlling the sound was more difficult than usual. And perhaps we should just let you know that when you hear this on Monday, we were talking last Friday. Perhaps we should say that in case you're wondering why we didn't tell you who won and all those important things about motor race meetings. Anyway, see you next month. Bye-bye.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.